ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, where we're still doing what we've done for nearly 40 years, examining what really matters in this changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
And it felt fugitive, an alternative.
And people were willing to take risks.
Hear it now with four brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT, when it was founded in 2015, had a mission to develop artificial intelligence tools that would benefit humanity. But somewhere along the way, that mission seems to have changed. And today on Big Ideas, American journalist Karen Howe on how the artificial intelligence arms race appears to be pursuing world domination at any cost.
If you follow this logic, then if you believe this logic, then you would cede everything to these companies. You would turn over all of your land to help them build supercomputers. You would turn over all of your energy to help power them, turn over all of your fresh water to help cool them, and then have no data privacy laws, no intellectual property laws, which is highly convenient, a highly convenient narrative that allows basically these empires to continue empire building.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell. Welcome to Big Ideas, where I bring you big thinkers at the best live events right here on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. In her new book, Empire of AI, Inside the Reckless Race for Total Domination, Karen Howe investigates the power struggles of the inner sanctum of the AI world and the harms inflicted on those in its way. Karen was recently named in Time magazine's list of top 100 people in AI in 2025. She is a former Wall Street Journal reporter, a former senior editor at MIT Technology Review, and she leads the Pulitzer Center's AI Spotlight series, which is a program training thousands of journalists across the world on how to cover AI. And she joins you today from RMIT University's Story Hall on Wurundjeri Country. It's another event in a series that featured American computational linguist Emily Bender, who was talking recently on Big Ideas about her book, The AI Con. And we'll link to that in our show notes. Karen Howe is in conversation today with Dr. Kobe Lyons, a self-described reformed lawyer and academic. She now sets up AI governance in organisations. Here they are.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here.
Where else would we rather be?
This is awesome.
So I want to start, first of all, I don't finish a lot of books these days because I've gotten older and I find it really hard to find books that keep me captivated. I actually had to pause in reading your book, not because I found it hard to read, but because I was so horrified. I don't know if others had the same experience, if anyone's had copies, but it's actually unbelievable. But it also feels like a really deeply personal project. So I'm going to ask you a question about how you got to writing it, and that took a long time and a lot of conversations to weave together.
Yeah, so I started writing this book without knowing it in 2019, and that was the year that I realized that OpenAI was making some interesting waves within the AI world. They had just released GPT-2. Sam Altman had become CEO. They'd gotten $1 billion investment from Microsoft, and they had created a for-profit arm within their nonprofit to raise that money. And so I ended up being the first journalist to profile OpenAI, and I embedded within the company for 3 days in 2019. I also started writing this book without knowing it in 2020 when I hit upon scholarship that was starting to make connections between the AI industry and colonialism. And I became really, really fascinated by this idea because these scholars were laying out really compelling arguments about the way that the industry just lays claim to resources that are not their own and exploits labor and deals with all of these types of resource and human extraction ultimately to fortify people that control, that help to help certain people at the top amass more wealth and power. And so I didn't realize at the time that those were two very, very connected threads. But as I continued reporting, after I finished the OpenAI profile, I ended up spending 2 years reporting on AI colonialism. And I initially, when I started thinking about writing a book, I thought I was actually just going to focus on AI colonialism and continue doing that work and just help people understand that this technology that is made out to be all sunshine and rainbows is actually, there's this really dark underbelly that we need to grapple with if we actually want to unlock the potential of this technology. Because I do believe that AI can have potential. But it really, really matters how we think about how we design it, what purpose it serves, and who it serves in the process. And then ChatGPT came out. Like, I was well underway into writing a proposal related to colonialism when ChatGPT changed everything. And my agent at the time was like, well, what does ChatGPT mean? Does it just fix all of our problems? And I was like, no, it makes it so much worse. And he was like, well, then you have to write about that. Like, you have to tell the story of this company and why it is an empire, an imperial project, and why it is ultimately leading us to a place with this technology and society, to places that we don't actually want to go. And that is what I then wrestled with for 1.5 years. I wrote this in a sprint because there's just so much happening, so much changing so fast that I couldn't afford to take any longer to write the book. I ended up developing like tendonitis in my hands because I was spending so long every day typing to just get this out at the speed that it needed to come out. But yeah, it did feel deeply personal in the sense that I was quite shocked and disappointed when ChatGPT came out, how it totally reset a lot of conversations within the AI space to be once again dominated by Silicon Valley's narratives about how this is all sunshine and rainbows. And there was so much rich accountability work that had been done beforehand that had just been overwritten. And I felt like it was really hard for the average person in the public to actually then ramp up to an understand a real understanding of this technology, because there's just so much noise. And I thought, I really want to create this artifact that someone can just pick up and help navigate this entire new world that we live in and understand how to grapple with and resist the forces at play.
And I think you've done a phenomenal job.
Thank you.
I think it's also worth referring to the conversations we had with Emily Bender before in terms of, I won't have these conversations without defining what AI is, because we keep talking as though everyone has a common understanding, but you use the phrase trench coat of technologies fairly regularly. Is that you?
I use suitcase word, which
is turned into trench coat down here. By the time it came to Australia, we didn't really...
Yeah, suitcase word, which is what Marvin Minsky used to call it, one of the founding fathers of the AI discipline. He said, Minsky is interesting, problematic figure in many ways, but he did make this contribution of articulating this pretty deep criticism of the fact that AI is just so poorly defined and you can just put whatever you want in the suitcase and suddenly AI becomes something new. And basically it just becomes whatever the most powerful people want it to be. But that doesn't necessarily mean it becomes what we need as a society for it to be.
Correct. And I have conversations regularly where people who think they know, once they start asking a few questions, you realize a lot of people are pretending that they know when they don't really understand or know. I really loved one of your comments was, this isn't a natural phenomenon. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Before we go there, though, I just want to say this is a country that's not unfamiliar with colonialism, and I think the titles really resonate. Before, we spoke before about how you have a different title for different markets. I'm really curious.
Yeah, so the title is the same, but the subtitle is different. This is the UK edition, which comes to most Commonwealth countries as well as all of Europe. And then there's a US edition that I don't know, it goes to other places in the world. But the US edition is that one, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's OpenAI. And the UK edition is Inside the Reckless Race for Total Domination. And basically, the way that my teams explained it to me, they were like, the U.S. likes good corporate drama, and the UK really likes a good empire story. And I was like, that makes sense.
And I think that frames the self-fulfilling prophecy from different lenses. So even the prophecy of, you know, the colonial empire being built versus the corporate empire being built is a slightly different lens. But
yeah,
tell us a bit more about the self-fulfilling prophecy. What makes that prophecy come true? What is the power behind the narratives? Who is driving those narratives? I think lots of people in Australia haven't received the book. It's only just come out this week, and the readings copies haven't necessarily arrived at people's houses. So lots of people will be very keen to know a bit more.
Yeah, so that was a line that was referring to specifically the way that OpenAI has framed its entire existence, basically, but also its approach to AI development. So a lot of people, if you listen to what Silicon Valley says, you will be under the impression that AI development requires an extraordinary amount of resources to develop, because the type of AI tools that they are currently working on are these large scale and what they like to define as general purpose AI systems that become chatbots or other types of large language models. And the reason why I put in air quotes general purpose is because these tools are not actually general purpose. If you start speaking to it in any language other than English, it already starts to break down. So how general purpose is it really? But of course, the quest that Silicon Valley is on, and the reason why they build these large-scale tools, is because they're trying to reach this ethereal goal of artificial general intelligence, a so-called everything machine that will ultimately solve all of our problems and cure all our ills. But they basically define this quest as this grand thing, this grand ambition. And then they say, in order to actually get there, we need to consume all of these resources. We need all of your data. And we need to just keep scaling and scaling and scaling these models to see, to arrive at this nebulous destination. And they basically, over the last few years, the AI industry has created what they call scaling laws, which is basically an observation that the more data that you put into AI models and the larger the supercomputer that you use to train these AI models, the more powerful they seem to be. So there's this relationship, this scaling relationship between data, what they call compute, and then the capability of the model. And if you follow this logic, then if you believe this logic, then you would cede everything to these companies. You would turn over all of your land to help them build supercomputers. You would turn over all of your energy to help power them, turn over all of your fresh water to help cool them, and then have no data privacy laws, no intellectual property laws, which is highly convenient, a highly convenient narrative that allows basically these empires to continue empire building. But these laws are, they're ultimately observations. And so they're not actually based in physics. They're not based in any kind of science. It is just an observation based on certain data that was collected within these companies. And then they extrapolate this narrative around that, that suggests that what they are doing, their quest, their consolidation of these resources is necessary and inevitable. And ultimately, it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I would absolutely love to have other laws in place that we use to drive what we're doing. And I suspect you would as well. I was sent this by Deb Verhoeven today, and I'm actually going to refer to it. It's by C.P. Snow, and I'll tell you when it was written shortly after I read it. It says, "Gadgets are the greatest single source of misjudgment that I've ever seen, or that anyone has ever seen in scientific decisions in our time. People get fascinated by gadgets. They love them. They want everything to be explained in terms of them." And then they go on to say, "I suspect that computers in government are going to get into the hands of persons with mildly defective or canalized judgment and become gadgets. It will be just astonishing if that does not happen." Now, we've just had one of the biggest payouts in Australia for something that didn't even involve AI. It involved a simple spreadsheet. RoboDebt was used to calculate payments and really targeted deliberately a very vulnerable group in a way that was incredibly harmful. But this piece was written in 1964. We've known about the risks of these tools and and what can be done with them very, very early on. As you write about, Joseph Weizenbaum talked about magical thinking, and as soon as you take that magical thinking away, then those, you know, you take the magic fairy dust off, and Emily talked about this a little bit as well. How do you do that? How do you inform people, or how do people get informed enough to have a conversation? Because I think a lot of people, some of the people in the room are experts, but to a generalist audience, it's very easy to be wowed by these narratives that you've described. I mean, these people are creating their own laws, they're creating their own stories, and those stories are driving and shaping our world so profoundly.
Yeah, I think the best way to counter those narratives is just evidence. Because
does that work anymore? Data, like real data.
So I'm a journalist because my theory of change is that if you present people with enough evidence about what's happening in the world, then they become informed and then they can participate in a democracy and be able to continue contributing to the betterment of our collective future. And I do really think that, like, part of what I really wanted to do with this book was just to document things, like document what actually happens within the walls of the company, but also what happens when their ideology then hits the ground, reality, and falls apart and actually ends up harming lots of people around the world. And, you know, like, sometimes I actually feel like you don't really need to know that much in-depth technical detail about these technologies to understand what they are about and who they serve. Like, I often talk to audiences who mention to me afterwards, like, they don't really know how to engage in, like, the technical levels of AI, but they do have a general feeling that technology no longer really works for them these days. Like, they are very frustrated with their relationship with their technology. They're frustrated with the way that technology affects their kids. And that, I think, is all you really need, right? Like, that is actually a really profound understanding of how Silicon Valley works. Like, the technologies that they build are not actually built to serve us. We are serving the tech industry. And that's what leaves us with that feeling that these tools, our smartphones, social media, the doom scrolling that we're really frustrated we keep doing, that's why we feel that way. And the AI industry comes from the same exact place. And so sometimes, like, it only takes a few pieces of evidence to show people this is what the AI industry is actually doing. And this is what, when Silicon Valley tells you this thing, like, what actually happens is that thing. It only takes, like, a couple pieces of evidence or people to suddenly connect it with the day-to-day experience that they have with technology and then to understand.
And I wonder if those technological frustrations ring true for you. Karen Howe is our big thinker today here on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Great to have you with us. Karen is an award-winning journalist. She is the best-selling author of the book Empire of AI. And she is in conversation here with lawyer, academic and AI advisor Dr. Kobe Lyons. And a heads up for Little Ears, a warning. A discussion on difficult themes, child pornography, up ahead.
This whole conversation around productivity, which I find so absurd because there's actually not a lot of evidence that generalist AI tools improve productivity. And yet,
in fact, there's plenty of evidence that it doesn't.
An MIT study that 95% of Gen AI tools actually bring no productivity with all of those costs that you've mentioned. And the 5% that succeed, I think, were good at spam. And yet we're still talking about productivity as though this is a real thing in this space, when in fact we could be talking about maybe equal salaries for men and women,
yeah,
or perhaps providing childcare and school systems that work within working hours for women. I don't know, like, there's some stuff we could do that would have really profound impacts. But to your point, it's not just that there's a general AI, it's a general solution for every problem now without the evidence or the data.
Yeah.
Which is one of the major problems. But I think that leads really nicely to another question. I've sort of just explained something rather than asked you a question. I don't think there was a mention, a notice by page 100, I think you'd mentioned Muradi Gebru and Sam's sister, Anne Altman. There are only three women up by page 100.
Mm.
And it became pretty clear that there weren't a whole lot more as the book went on.
Yeah.
What is the nature of the sort of the gendered lens in these conversations? Obviously, Emily is very vocal, you're very vocal, so both in terms of the activists and the people who are speaking out, but also the people who sit in places of power in this just seem to be as Timmet would call them, the minoritized don't really have a voice, back to our voice theme. So
yeah, completely.
Would you like to say a little bit more about that in your research and your conversations?
Yeah, actually, you know, I just attended an event in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago where they released some new research on the average Californian and how they feel about AI and AI governance. And it turned out that one of the strongest signals for being positive versus negative on AI is gender. So women are just more naturally are critical and worried about the technology, and men are more positive about the technology. And it's not really clear necessarily why from the study, but from my personal experience, I think the reason why is because as a woman in the world, you end up interacting with a lot of AI systems that just do not work for you. I had this experience where I was being interviewed by Chris Hayes, who's an MSNBC anchor, and he was telling me about how he sometimes feels like it's hard not to believe these Silicon Valley companies because his fraud detection system at his bank is just so accurate. Like, he sometimes makes an impulse purchase and then it doesn't flag it for fraud. And then other times there is actually fraudulent activity and it accurately flags it. And he was like, I mean, that predictive capability is so powerful. It does make you think that like these systems can be then trained to do much higher order predictions that then become more like complex levels of quote unquote intelligence. And I burst out laughing in the middle of the interview because I was like, every time I travel, I need at least three forms of payment with me because every single time I get flagged for fraud when I'm trying to make a legitimate transaction. And there's now no way for me to contest that freezing of my credit card because it's all automated now. So I can't even like click a button on the app to say, no, that was a legitimate transaction. Please let it through. And so I think even just that, I mean, that's a small example, but you end up encountering not just AI systems, just like the ways that technology and just systems in general are not designed for you. And it makes you start questioning a lot more the general power structures and who is ultimately being privileged in these spaces and with this technology. And so in the book, I end up highlighting part of that with Timni Gebru's story, who she was the ethical AI team lead, co-leader at Google. And for a long time, for 2 years, her presence at Google really burnished Google's reputation as really a leader in responsible AI development because they hired someone like her. She's a very prestigious researcher, had gone to Stanford, studied under Fei-Fei Li, and they literally hired her to critique the AI services and products that Google was building.
Until they didn't like what she said.
Yes, and they built, almost entirely female team of other scholars who had deep technical expertise, all had PhDs in like computer science and sociology and all of these different disciplines that were then dedicated to critiquing these systems. And then none of them survived that corporate culture because when push came to shove, profits mattered more. And then all of them ended up leaving. And it's sort of the same story again and again and again, where a lot of women who end up, they have this lens, this critical lens on these systems. When they start raising questions, they're the first ones kicked out.
And I think from a concrete example, like I often give talks to people trying to explain these tools, and I say something as simple as this, you know, to audiences of women, you could have an algorithm or any vulnerable population, you could have an algorithm that gives you the safe places to walk at night. You could have an algorithm that tells you the places that are lit or even the places that are environmentally sustainable, which I think Google has now since brought in, which reduces that argument a little bit. But the point is there are so many different ways to view the world, mm-hmm. and just the simple tools that we're using are shaping how we're moving in that world. And I think women are often more aware of the impacts and the vulnerabilities. But they're not the only group. There are many others. And you go into great depth. And this was a chapter where I actually had to pause because I've been in this field a long time and I'd heard a lot of the stories, but the detail and the depth with which you research the data workers, the data labeling. I've had a request from a conversation with someone who works here to talk about human rights. It is not human rights respecting in any way, but I found it horrifying how the data workers were actually being, there are a couple of things that were horrifying. This is one of them, that they were moving from country, these companies are moving from country to country deliberately in a way that is using and burning out people. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I don't think people understand how much training goes into the labelling. Again, it's the magic tin that does all the automation, but
yeah.
The cost, the human cost.
Yeah, so anything that an AI tool can do has at some point been done by a human first and shown to the AI tool. That's what allows these AI tools to have their capabilities. They don't come in a magic box. They don't learn by themselves the way that companies try to portray it. There are teams of thousands, tens of thousands of workers, predominantly in the global south, that are doing very detailed data annotation, data preparation, data cleaning work. Originally, there ended up being a boom in this outsourcing during the self-driving car industry. So one of the challenges of self-driving cars is that the annotation has to be pristine, because if you annotate an image and do not flag a pedestrian in that image, and then that image is shown to a self-driving car that's supposed to then navigate around pedestrians, that could be a life or death difference. And so there started being all of these different sweatshops, basically, that popped up all around these different countries in the global south to provide the cheap labor for servicing the AI industry in this regard. And Scale AI, which has been in the headlines recently because Meta made a multi-billion dollar acquisition of the CEO and founder of Scale AI, Alexander Wang, to run their super intelligence team. Scale AI was one of the startups that really dominated in developing a reputation as the go-to vendor for this kind of labor. And early on, they went to Kenya and the Philippines as an American company outsourcing. These are obvious outsourcing locations because of colonialism. Kenya and the Philippines. Philippines used to be an American colony. So very, very linguistically, like similar, culturally similar. And Kenya, of course, used to be a British colony, so also understands English. These are both highly educated places. They have good internet connectivity and then large bases of people that are willing to work for very, very cheap. They noticed, as they set up their platform, anyone around the world could technically sign up, even though they were cultivating bases in the Philippines and Kenya. They noticed a sudden surge in signups from Venezuela. And they realized it was because Venezuela was experiencing the worst peacetime economic crisis in 50 years. So this is a very oil-driven economy. The state oil company cratered, and the economy went in a tailspin with it. Very, very highly educated people suddenly were queuing in lines for like a loaf of bread for like hours, and in like dire conditions, willing to basically work for any price. And so Scale thought, what a convenient business opportunity.
Great opportunity, yeah.
So they immediately set up shop in Venezuela. They recreated their entire platform in the Spanish language. They started recruiting all of these people in the country to rally other workers to join. They created this onboarding process where it was just riddled with gifts of people showering in US dollars, which in Venezuela, like, their currency was experiencing hyperinflation, like historic levels of hyperinflation. So everyone was trying to get their hands on US dollars as just the single stable currency that they could operate with. So it was like just extremely exploitative recruiting tactics. And then they onboarded these workers onto projects where sometimes the workers would work for weeks and then not get paid because the platform had bugs. They also pit the workers against each other. So the way that the platform would sometimes operate is they would just post tasks from AI companies onto a central queue, and then whoever claimed it fastest got to do the task and maybe earn money at the end of the task if they were lucky and didn't have bugs on their version of the platform. And yeah, this became essentially a playbook for the data annotation industry for supplying extremely cheap labor to the AI industry. They started looking for other countries undergoing economic crisis in order to keep their prices low and allow the AI industry to continue profiting without actually having to compensate people that are actually doing the lifeblood work of the AI industry. These are the people that literally make, you know, ChatGPT know how to chat. And in the end, one of the companies that Scale AI famously then started deepening their relationships with was OpenAI.
there'll be some people who are listening to this that say that's just business. You go where things are cheap, you do the work, you source cheap labour. That's kind of the beauty of globalisation. But I think there's another element to this, and this kind of brings me to the point that probably horrified me the most, that in the development of DALL-E 3, they couldn't actually remove, the share of the pornographic images on the internet was so large that removing them shrank the training data set to notably degrade the model's performance. So if you think about that for a minute, you had to have pornographic, and a lot of these people are sorting through what is violence, what is appropriate for children, what is appropriate porn. In particular, it made the model worse at generating faces of women and people of colour due to the same discovery. A significant share of the online content depicting both groups is sexually explicit.
Yeah.
That's really dark, but that means if you pulled out the porn images of people of colour and women,
then it stops,
being able to function.
Yeah. So the thing that I critique again and again in the book is the fact that the industry has chosen the scaling paradigm for advancing AI development. They have chosen to continue pouring in that data, continue building larger and larger supercomputers. And this is wholly unnecessary from a technical perspective. Before OpenAI chose this path, there was a vast array of other research that was happening that demonstrated that you could actually advance AI research with teeny amounts of data, teeny computers. Like, people were training powerful AI models on mobile phones and all other kinds of ideas around just how to create more efficient AI systems that are actually, in fact, more robust in some ways than these colossal models, because these colossal models often break down and we don't really know how they work because we don't really know what we put into them. But OpenAI decided to take this scaling approach. And one of the challenges then is the data quality plummets, because the larger you scale the data, the more lenient you are about what data you put into your model, because you're going for volume now over actual quality.
And you're trawling the bottom of the ocean for everything that's in that net.
Yeah.
Basically pile it in.
Because they were looking at their scaling laws and they were like, in order for us to get this type of capability, we need whatever, this number of petabytes of data. And so just to reach that amount of data, they were going everywhere. This was true for their text models and their image models. So with their text models, originally with GPT-2, which was two generations before ChatGPT, they had actually not looked at certain types of data because it was so low quality. And by GPT-4, they just decided that there was no quality bar and they just had to take everything, because otherwise they would never reach that threshold that they needed. And with the images, it was the same exact thing. So they originally thought, we will have some pornographic content, because just they decided that sex is just part of life, so our AI systems should represent pornographic, should have pornographic imagery in them. Very problematic decision that they didn't actually consult anyone with, you know, child safety.
It's almost as though there were no women in the room for that decision.
Well, interestingly, I think there might have been one. But it wasn't a democratic decision. They sort of just had a conversation where they're like, should we not? Yeah, why not? And one of the problems is when you pour that stuff in, these models are capable of what's called compositional generation. So you can pour in images of avocados and pour in images of chairs. And then OpenAI, when they released the model, they were like, and look, it can generate avocado chairs, where it's like these couches and
they were
stylized
missing from
as
our
avocados.
Lives beforehand, weren't they? We really needed those.
Yeah. And then if you think about it, if you put in children and then you put in pornography, then you get synthetic child pornography. And that has now become a huge problem. And that was, you know, the decision was made behind closed doors in sort of a split second judgment. But the other thing is that as they pour more of these images in, they also just have no idea what's in it anymore, because these data sets become so vast that you cannot actually manually account for everything that's in it. So even if they wanted to clean out certain aspects of what they're putting in, it would be really hard because they have to use automated methods to take out the things that they don't want. And automated methods are imperfect. So there's always going to be some level of junk that ends up getting just indiscriminately batched in. And then there's a third layer of, then they started realizing, oh, wait, maybe we shouldn't have so much pornographic imagery. Let's take it out. Oh, no, our model no longer generates faces of women as accurately. Let's just put it back in. So, yeah, like this entire scaling paradigm, just as you follow the logic of what kinds of harms it then leads to, there's just an absolute abundance of various different harms that, again, were wholly unnecessary from a technical perspective.
Some of the disturbing consequences of unrestrained progress in the world of AI with American journalist and author Karen Howe. She's in conversation with lawyer, academic and digital ethics consultant Kobe Lyons today here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. You're joining me, Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have you with us. And you can find all our episodes as podcast wherever you get them, especially on the ABC Listen app. Now, all empires end eventually, you assume. So what about the AI empire? That's next.
I feel like we're just discussing all of the fun stuff right now, so let's move to something really heavy. Let's talk about cults. I think one of my favourite, and as someone who's had some experience with some cults, I really, which is a whole other conversation.
You need to explain that a little bit.
That's for another talk. But the throwing of the crosses into the fire, the men in the white robe, like, can you just tell us a little bit? Because I think there's this, I mean...
Can I actually just read that passage?
Sure, go for it. That bit made me laugh out loud. Because on the one hand, you've got these incredibly powerful people using tools that are changing our world and the whole shape of the world in ways that you've described. But this passage just moved me. It was, I'll let you get to it while you're looking at it. I think we should also just bring in that really light and fun topic of narcissism, because that was another theme that came up for me in this book, that there are just so many characters. And in the context of the tools themselves, for those who've been following just while you're looking at, following these ChatGPT stories where people talk to the systems and then basically think they've fallen in love with them. And because, it's because the systems are doing a thing called glazing. They're now calling glazing, right? So they say really nice things. And I don't know if anyone saw the Gemini story where they took the glazing off and this poor system sounded really depressed. It was like, oh, can't really do that. Anyway, this, the cult, back to the cult.
Okay, so one of I'll contextualize it a bit before
cults.
I read this. One of the things that surprised me the most when I started reporting on the book is, in general, you hear lots of narratives in the public that AI is going to save us all or AI is going to kill us all. And I really thought that this was just rhetoric coming out of Silicon Valley, because ultimately both these narratives portray AI as all-powerful, AI as something that needs to be controlled, and therefore something that should continue being controlled by Silicon Valley. But what I realized is that there are actually quasi-religious movements that have developed within Silicon Valley, where there are factions of people that genuinely believe one or the other narrative. They genuinely believe that artificial general intelligence is imminent, it is going to be cataclysmically transformative for the human species, and that transformation will either be positive and bring us to utopia or negative and demise us all. I'm just gonna, yeah, now
please,
I'm gonna,
this
I'm
passage gonna, yeah. is just.
Among many employees, GPT-4 solidified the belief that AGI was possible. Researchers who were once skeptical felt increasingly bullish about reaching such a technical pinnacle, even while OpenAI continued to lack a definition of what exactly it was. Engineers and product managers joining the Applied team, and having their first close-up interaction with AI through GPT-4 adopted even more deterministic language. For many employees, the question became not if AGI would happen, but when. Some employees also felt exactly the opposite. While there was a clear qualitative change in what GPT-3 would do over GPT-2, GPT-4 was just bigger, says one researcher who worked on the model. The big result was that there were a bunch of exams that the model does well, but even that is highly questionable. OpenAI never did a comprehensive review of GPT-4's training data to check whether those exams and their answers were just in the data and being regurgitated, or whether GPT-4 had in fact developed a novel capability to pass them. It was the kind of shaky science that had become pervasive with the industry-wide shift from peer-reviewed to PR-reviewed research. But the belief that AI had reached fundamentally new heights was in the water. At Google that spring, Blake Lemoine, an engineer on the tech giant's newly reformed responsible AI team, grew convinced that the company's own large language model, Lambda, was not only highly intelligent, but could be considered sentient. He said this was not based on a scientific assessment, but rather on his belief as a mystic Christian priest that God could decide to give technology consciousness. "Who am I to tell God where he can and can't put souls?" he wrote. When company executives dismissed him, he went public with the Washington Post. Natasha Tiku, the reporter who broke the story, also spoke to Emily Bender and Meg Mitchell, who had warned in their Stochastic Parrots paper about the problem of large language models fooling people into seeing real meaning and intent behind their generations. "We now have machines that can mindlessly generate words, but we haven't learned how to stop imagining a mind behind them," said Bender. Nikhil Mishra, the AI researcher who interned at OpenAI in its early days, draws parallels to an experiment in the 1970s that sought to teach a gorilla a modified form of American Sign Language. Over her lifetime, the gorilla, named Coco, seemed to learn more than 1,000 signs and even the ability to construct sentences. But despite enormous public fanfare, other experts argued that Coco never truly acquired the language. While she was certainly skilled at forming gestures, there was little evidence that she was doing more than what other apes had done across many similar experiments, simply mirroring the gestures of their caretakers. No data was ever published of Coco's signing to independently verify her capabilities, only curated videos of her showcasing them. At times, her live performances begged further scrutiny. Once, when her trainer asked Coco whether she liked people, Coco signed, "Fine nipple." The trainer immediately explained, "Nipple rhymes with people. Coco thought people were fine." To many observers, these episodes revealed more about human psychology and our tendency to project our own beliefs and ideas of intent than about Coco's ability. The trainer, Mishra says, was assigning meaning where there wasn't any. For OpenAI's own resident mystic, Ilya Sutskever, who had...
This is a corker.
He was the chief scientist, who had always believed more than most researchers in the likelihood of achieving AGI in the short term. The leap in the company's model capabilities served only as further confirmation. He grew convinced that he was witnessing a form of reasoning. In conversations with Jeffrey Hinton, Sutskever told his mentor that AGI was imminent. Where before, Sutskever focused more on pushing OpenAI researchers to advance new capabilities, he shifted his attention to AI safety research with new urgency. He began his mantra, "Feel the AGI," and urged people to prepare themselves for dramatic changes. "You're suddenly going to be the most popular person at a party," he told employees. "You need to not let that get to your head. Stay focused on AGI. Stay focused on the mission." That September, the technical leadership held an offsite at the Tenaya Lodge, a remote luxury resort nestled in the lush folds of the Sierra Nevada. The property, furnished with stunning interiors and multiple pools and restaurants, sat only 2 miles away from the millions of acres of pristine wilderness in Yosemite National Park. On the first night, everyone gathered around a fire pit on the rear patio of the hotel. Senior scientists, dressed in bathrobes, flanked the fire in a semicircle. Then Sutskever emerged. In the pit, he had placed a wooden effigy that he'd commissioned from a local artist and began a dramatic performance. "This effigy," he explained, "represented a good, aligned AGI that OpenAI had built, only to discover it was actually lying and deceitful. OpenAI's duty," he said, "was to destroy it." Only a few yards away, several redwoods stood like ancient witnesses in the darkness. Sutskever doused the effigy in lighter fluid and lit it on fire.
Thank you so much. These are the people running our world. I feel confident. we're running low on time, and I really want to circle back to what everyone wants to know, which is, how is the empire going to end? And I don't expect you to have those answers, so I'm not actually going to ask you that question, even though you're all expecting it, because I know what it's like to write a book and be asked how to solve all the problems of the universe, and I don't think it's fair to ask you that. But I am going to use a question from Kathy Reid, which I think is fantastic. In the last chapter about alternatives, you mentioned the work by Tehiku Media, and this comes back to our conversation where we started about voice and about intent as well. Led by Peter Lucas Jones and Kiona Mahalona, they're a couple in business and real life. They don't release Te Reo, which is the Maori data, publicly. It's held under a license which requires benefits from the data go back to the community. How might this work apply to Indigenous Australian data and language, which Google has been working with recently? And how can we use these kinds of examples to actually not be the men in bathrobes throwing effigies into a fire?
Yeah, so I guess to elaborate a little bit on the Tehiku Media story, what I sort of mentioned in the beginning is I am not critical of all of AI. I am critical specifically of Silicon Valley's conception of AI, but I do think that if we reconceived of AI to mean something fundamentally different and design it in totally different ways, that it can be really transformative and actually redistributing power rather than consolidating it. And Tehiku Media is a perfect example because they're a Maori radio station in New Zealand, and they really wanted to contribute to the nationwide effort to revitalize the Maori language. And they had all of this rich archival audio in Te Reo Maori that allowed people who are learning the language to hear their ancestors speak it. Many of their recordings actually existed there were recordings of elders where their Te Reo Māori had not yet been distorted by the sounds of English. And so it was really precious. And they thought, in order to open this up, we need to not just release the audio, but we want to transcribe the audio and then create these interactive learning tools where people can listen, see, and then click on the words and see a definition pop up. But that meant they had to transcribe the audio, and there are very few Te Reo Māori speakers that have the proficiency to do that. So they decided, let's create a AI speech recognition tool for doing that work. And so they went about producing their AI in a totally different way than OpenAI. They first asked for consent from the community. Do you want this AI tool? Which is, it's sad to say it's radical, but it is really radical.
It's really hard in a context, in a corporate context, to say what problems does your business face before the AI conversation. That's
right.
Really familiar to me, and people are surprised by that. Just that, what are your problems before we get to the tools, is really political.
Yeah, like, what are your problems, and then let's figure out what kinds of technologies are going to solve it, because AI is not going to solve everything. AI doesn't lend itself to every single problem. But in this particular case, once they scoped out the problem, they were like, oh, wait, this actually does lend itself to the computational strengths of AI technologies. So then they go to their community, they get consent from the community, then they explain to the community what is it actually going to take. They collect a bunch of data that is also given to them with full consent, participation of the community, and then they create this model that's tiny because it's small, task-specific, and it's trained on curated data sets rather than indiscriminately scraped data sets. So when you have high-quality data sets, the computational resources required to create the models immediately plummets. And so then they went back to the community and said, now that we have the speech recognition tool, what kinds of learning resources do you want? What other types of AI technologies might you want? And then they had this license to say, like, now that we have this data, we're going to guard the data to make sure that it doesn't end up getting used for some purpose that you did not donate it for. And so at every stage, there was participation, there was democratic input, there was consent, and there was a very clear idea of how is this technology going to serve us? How do we design it at every single step to make sure that it works for us and redistributes power, helps them reclaim their language and reverse a historic injustice rather than re-entrench it? And so I guess to go to your question of, like, how do we actually fix the empire? The vision that I see for AI is one in which people first center what are the things that we actually need in this world as people. Better healthcare, better education, clean air, clean water, better human rights in general. And then what aspects of those problems actually lend themselves to the strengths of AI. And then we can think about how do we curate data in a consensual way that creates these tools and then broadly distributes them and involves the communities whose data is actually being used and who will ultimately be impacted by the tools and hopefully be benefiting from the tools. And I think if in order to get to that kind of more broad distribution of community-driven participatory AI development, we need people to basically resist every single aspect of the supply chain of the imperial type of AI development. And we are actually seeing that. Like, we are seeing artists and writers now that are litigating and suing these companies, and that is resisting...
Data centers.
Yeah, right. So there's resistance on the data collection. There's resistance on data centers. There are actually communities that have successfully stalled data center development because the data center is not at all benefiting their community, and these companies enter into communities without any transparency whatsoever. There are lots of schools that are starting to revisit the conversation around AI governance in terms of applying AI, using AI, adopting AI in the community, instead of wholesale saying, yes, everyone's going to use AI, or no, no one's going to use AI, bringing together students, teachers, and parents to have an actual debate about how do we want AI to work for us, and where do we see it actually improving and strengthening our educational goals, and where do we see it actually degrading our educational goals? What types of AI tools and services are actually doing one versus the other? And I think if we can have more of that resistance and what I call democratic contestation along the full supply chain of AI development 100,000 times fold, that's how the empire falls. And then we shift towards a more democratic vision of AI development.
I think you just fixed it.
We solved the problems.
Dismantling the Empire. Karen Howe, American journalist, author of the New York Times best-selling book Empire of AI, Inside the Reckless Race for Total Domination. It's quite a title, isn't it? Look, it's a must-read, I think, for anyone using these technologies, and that's a lot of us. And some of us are using them whether we know it or like it or not. Karen Howe, speaking to lawyer, academic and AI consultant Kobe Lyons there with an audience at RMIT University in Naarm, Melbourne. Thanks to all involved. And if you'd like to tell us about what you're hearing, your response, your thoughts, your reflections, we love getting them. We love getting your feedback. You can email it to us, bigideas@abc.net.au. Next time on Big Ideas, how did a Kiwi art historian become a world-leading Australian-based codebreaker of Japanese messages during the Second World War? It's a great yarn.
His contribution to that war effort was certainly very significant. His natural abilities, including the mathematical mind, an aptitude for and training in languages, certainly would have made him a prime candidate for a role as a codebreaker. But I'd argue that it was also his skills in connoisseurship in ancient Greek vase painting, in this attribution of South Italian vases to particular painters, which was a critical factor also. Now, there was a book published recently about Monterey and also the Brisbane groups of cryptographers in Australia during the Second World War. And this book doesn't mention Trendall much, but it does briefly note that Trendall's skills as a linguist were important for his war work, but also that he was a world expert on South Italian pottery. And the book says, not much use in solving codes. I would argue to the contrary. It was precisely Trendall's ability and experience in detecting significant patterns in the large amount of graphic information provided by thousands of South Italian vases, which, along with his linguistic skills, made him a brilliant cryptographer.
An intriguing story of art, espionage, and the extraordinary career of a man named Professor A.D. Trendall. In our next episode of Big Ideas, be sure not to miss that one. Our show is produced by Karin Zivanovits, Claire Slattery, and me, your host, Natasha Mitchell. Our sound engineer, David LeMay, who joins a team of engineers across the country recording live events so that we can bring them right here to you on Big Ideas. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.